Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we learn about a company that's creating signature scents for various colleges and universities. We talk to the publisher of the magazine Innocent Words about its move away from print. Take a tour of the unusual and sometimes unsettling Glore Psychiatric Museum. And we hear about one young doctor's unexpected lunch with Marlon Brando. We'll have those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. An exhibit underway at Chicago's Museum of Contemporary Art gives insight into what it's like to be deaf. Chicago artist Joseph Grigley uses video, audio, sculpture, and paper to take a funny and touching look at communication. Along the way, he pays homage to mundane conversations about things like kitty litter that we take for granted. Lynette Kalsness has more.
If you can imagine going deaf as a kid, think about the audio that will be stuck in your head. For artist Joseph Grigley, it's commercials and the Gilligan's Island theme song. That's why he calls one of his pieces, "Remembering is a Difficult Job, but Somebody Has to Do It." He sings about Gilligan from a TV screen framed by palm trees and a huge screen showing icy water.
With Gilligan, the skipper too.
Grigley had already lost most of his hearing from a fever when he was little. Then, when he was 10, he was out playing King of the Mountain. He got pushed off the hill, went rolling down, and landed on a stick that went in his good ear.
It's kind of weird, though, because you open your eyes and reach the bottom, and all the friends are standing over you, and they're waving their arms, and everything was weirdly quiet.
He says it was like watching the world with the sound turned off. He was deaf from that moment on. When Grigley's talking with someone, he'll often ask them to write a note to aid communication. One day, after dinner with a friend, he found scraps of paper all over the studio. He laid them out and was intrigued by the strange fragments of words and drawings. Nothing made total sense.
And then it made sense by not making sense.
That was the starting point for him to make art. Now he saves all those notes. He mounts them on the wall in loose narrative form. They say things like, "Too much whiskey, but I am a painter. He bit my nose," or, "I don't think the monkey can be made to want to fish." His wife, artist Amy Vogel, collaborates from time to time and often interprets for him.
Joseph and I often talk about how, you know, you can hire interpreters for often really important things, but not for overhearing. And in schools, kids get interpreters for class, but not for the playground or the lunchroom or in the bathroom. So those little everyday things really do have a kind of meaning.
Grigley likes to imagine that every word we speak becomes a material object, and he envisions the words piling up in the garbage or taking over the kitchen. Amy Vogel explains.
Looking at Joseph's work, it does come back to sort of the humor and, I'll say it, beauty of like the everyday and just the subtle differences in all of us as human beings.
Russia.
A piece called You features five silver speakers hanging from the ceiling. A series of people try to say the name of artist Ed Ruscha.
Comes out from the time when a lot of people were talking about how my work's about my deafness, and I'm trying to explain, no, it's not about me, it's about how other people communicate.
Like when they write him notes and can no longer rely on the flourishes of speech to get their message across, or when there are mistakes in lip reading, like in his video installation, St. Cecilia.
Johnny wants a pair of skates.
On one screen, a choir sings traditional Christmas songs. On the screen next to it, you look at the choir and you'd swear they're singing the same thing. But you walk to the other speaker and you hear this.
Johnny was a bastard child, Doozy wants a collie.
Yes, they are singing Johnny was a bastard child and Doozy wants a collie. Grigley gathered mistakes people make lip reading to create these lyrics. A friend asked Grigley once what he does with his anger over being deaf, because it's the humor, not the anger, that shows in his art. Grigley says it's like renting a storage unit on the edge of town.
I kind of keep the anger out there, But someday I'll have to go back to that storage unit and clean it out and make something out of it.
Until he's ready to deal with anger in his art, he wants to share the wonder he feels in everyday conversations about cat litter and ice fishing. I'm Lynette Kalsnes.
This is Sidetrack. Ever wonder what your favorite college or university would smell like if it was bottled and sold in stores? Katie Masich is doing just that. She is the president and CEO of Masich Collegiate Fragrances. She is creating what she calls signature scents for various schools. Already, her company has a fragrance line for Penn State and the University of North Carolina, with several others in development. I talked with Masich recently about the scents and how she creates them. What goes into creating these scents? And I really hope it's not the smell of the bars on Friday night.
No. Although great part about college, not exactly a great inspiration for a fragrance we want to wear. It's a pretty detailed process that we do to create the signature scent. What we do, it's called a brief in the fragrance industry. It's essentially a presentation all about the university. We look at things like, what are the school colors and how can those be translated into aromatics? So for a school like Alabama, you got that crimson, you think red, berry, pomegranate, apple, red scents. You got a school like Tennessee, you think orange scents, mandarin, ginger, citrus, etc. We also look at campus flowers and trees. Certainly something that grows down at the University of Florida is quite different than University of Michigan or Illinois, etc. That goes into it. We look at the campus architectural style and landmarks and what kind of style they exude. And our perfumers are incredible at translating things such as architecture into scent. So if something is more soft and romantic, like the Old Well at North Carolina, or if something is more like the Nittany Lion, loyal, classic, true, etc. So all this goes into a big presentation to the perfumers. We take pictures of the campus, and they in turn formulate various scents for the school for men and women.
So is it more of an art or a science in this translation? Because some of these things that you list on your website as the criteria for making a scent seem, you know, like one of them is tradition and history. That's kind of a, you know, it's a more of a concept than something
exactly,
solid.
Exactly, yes. I mean, some things are a direct translation. For example, LSU campus is covered in oak trees, so we had our perfumers pull a woody oak aromatic. But some things are more of an abstract concept mood translation, and the perfumers are incredible at doing that. They've been trained extensively in chemistry and aromatics, and they can translate abstract things into scent. So it's definitely an art and science. Fragrances are an art and a science. And I'm a chemical engineer by degree, so I love the science behind it. And it's just a really neat process that goes into it.
So what made you think that, hey, I need to make scents for universities around the country? How did this idea come about?
You know, it kind of just came to me. I had always wanted to do a fragrance line because I love fragrances. I have since I was a little girl. And I wanted to do something different and something unique. So oftentimes fragrances celebrate the glitz and glamour of celebrities and fashion designers. And I thought, why don't we celebrate something that is, you know, we experience firsthand, something that's a part of us, something that has that nostalgia, whether you're a fan or alumni. And I thought, what about your college? And it really just, it just kind of came to me. And I looked at the market and no one else had done it in this way, or I hadn't really seen it out there. So I went for it.
So which fragrances do you have already?
What we have out in the market right now is the University of North Carolina and Penn State University. We launched those two schools. What I'm working on right now that will launch roughly April is LSU in Florida. And then shortly thereafter, we're going to launch Alabama, Auburn, Tennessee, and Georgia. And I've got a lot of schools calling me, students, staff, alumni, you name it, that want a signature sent. So we're very busy.
So Penn State, North Carolina, the ones you have right now, describe those scents and what makes them unique to their particular school.
Sure. I'll start out with Carolina. Carolina's scent is for the men's, because we do a men's and a women's. The men's is essentially Carolina Blue in a bottle. We told our perfumers, if you could take Carolina Blue and bottle it up, what would it smell like? So it's very light and crisp. It's kind of a water scent, as we say in the industry. It's got some bergamot, iced juniper, lavender, white pepper. It's a really, really nice fresh scent. And for the women's for Carolina, we said, okay, what's the iconic structure at Carolina is the Old Well. It's very romantic. A lot of people get engaged there. We said we want Carolina for women to be a very romantic, light, feminine scent. So our perfumers used rose, baby violet, vanilla, jasmine. So that's Carolina. Now Penn State, on the other hand, Penn State men's, Penn State is kind of that deep classic blue. Penn State has a lot of woody aromatics, those Penn State colors. So we use notes like blue cypress, cracked pepper, vetiver, cool moss, black amber. Penn State for women is inspired by Old Main, or the white of the Penn State blue and white. Old Main is a gorgeous, elegant building up on Penn State's campus. So it's got white patchouli, it's got a bourbon vanilla, it's got a dewberry blossom. So that's basically the rundown. They're very different. I wish you could smell through the phone here, but they're really different fragrances.
Well, it seems rather complex. I mean, it's I didn't realize there was so much into going into making a scent and a fragrance.
Yes, it is. It's been a learning experience for myself as well. It's really incredible what goes into it, and we have wonderful perfumers that are just so talented, and they've formulated for Ralph Lauren, Calvin Klein, Marc Jacobs. They're just really incredible. We're lucky to be working with them.
Well, of course, you know, I'm calling you from the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, and I don't know if you've looked into this, but, you know, our colors are orange and blue. We've got a giant UFO-looking assembly hall. We're an older Big Ten school. Sort of off the top of your head, what do you think for somebody like us?
Someone like you, I would definitely have to do my research. I'm not as familiar with your school as I am with some of the other ones I've been working on. But, I mean, if you look at with orange, we typically do a mandarin. We bring in some ginger. You think of orange scents, probably some citrus. You're there toward the north, so we'd probably look to see what kind of trees and vegetation are on your campus to bring in some woody base notes there. Base notes is what we call for those heavier aromatics in the fragrances. And the blue is very classic. There's a lot of different aromatics that our perfumers could work with the blue color there. But it's a lot of fun, and we certainly get the universities involved. We bring back the fragrances that have been formulated. We always do like a little focus group and have the universities give input into what they like best.
If people want to know more about your university fragrances, where should they go?
They can check us out on our website, which is masik.com, and they can read all about us and check out the fragrances, and they can certainly request schools there. We have a link to request schools, so definitely check it out.
That was Katie Masich, president and CEO of Masik Collegiate Fragrances. You're listening to Sidetrack. Now, the story of a young doctor questioning his choices, a cinema icon, and the conversation that changed them both.
My name is Wayne Liebman. I was born in Los Angeles, where I still live. And this happened many years ago when I was an intern in surgery at UCLA Medical Center, which is now called the David Geffen School of Medicine. It was another time, and being a surgical intern was kind of like being a prisoner of war. You slept very little, you had no time, you essentially lived at the hospital. So one afternoon I was hanging out at the nurse's station on 7 East with some of the nurses, and behind me, a couple of them started tittering and whispering among themselves, saying, "No, it's him. It's him. It's Marlon Brando." And this made no sense because I knew all the patients on the ward, and Marlon Brando wasn't one of them. But I looked down the hall, and there was a man, kind of shabbily dressed. He was leaning against the wall outside the room of a patient who had just gone down for a kidney transplant. And it was most definitely Brando. At this point in my life, I was very unhappy. And I'd begun transitioning away from medicine, thinking it had been a very big error. And I had started taking acting classes during my last year of medical school, although being an intern had put a stop to that for the time, which made me feel even more like a prisoner. And so I just kind of watched him, and then he started slowly walking toward the nurse's station. And I completely froze. I didn't know what to do. And very politely, in a subdued tone, he said, "Excuse me, is there a place away from the cafeteria where I could get something to eat?" I wouldn't have had the presence of mind to formulate an answer to that question, but the clerk, who was a big, strapping guy, very gentle, was completely unfazed, and he looked Brando straight in the eye, and he said, "No, there isn't," which was true. And Brando, disappointed, kind of nodded and walked back to his spot. And this idea began forming in my head, which was very scary. But I said to myself, "Wayne, do you want to meet Marlon Brando?" So I waited a minute, and the conversation at the nurse's station started up again, and very casually I walked over to where Brando was and said to him, "You know, I heard your question, and I was just going down to the cafeteria anyway to get my lunch. Would you like me to bring you back something to eat?" And his expression, which had been kind of closed, changed. He broke into this big smile. He got very warm and grateful, and he said, "Oh," and then he read my name tag, "Dr. Liebman. That would be wonderful. Thank you." And I said, "Great. I'll be right back." And I didn't want to wait for the elevator, so I ducked into a stairwell and I ran down 7 flights of stairs into the cafeteria, which was very crowded. I was bumping into people and realized Brando was right not to want to come down there. And I grabbed a tray and started piling things into it because I had no idea what he would want to eat. But I had these meal cards, and whatever we could put on a tray was free. You just gave the cashier the card when you were done. And I'm thinking to myself, "Oh my God, Marlon Brando, oh my God." So I got sandwiches and fruit and Jell-O and pie and this ridiculous pile of food. And I paid for it with the card, and I ran to the stairwell with the tray, running up 7 flights of stairs, praying he would still be there. And I stopped on the landing at the 7th floor, completely out of breath. And I couldn't go in because I didn't want him to see me out of breath. So I waited a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, until my body calmed down and I could talk normally. And all the time I'm thinking, "Just please be there. Please be there." And I casually opened the door, and he was right where I left him. And I carried the tray over to where he was, and his eyes lit up when he saw the food. And I thought, this pile of food looks so stupid. And I began to explain about the meal card, and I said, "Hey, you know, take whatever you like." And suddenly he got really shy, and he said, "Dr. Liebman, would you have time to have lunch with me?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." So we walked into the waiting room, which was empty, and we sat down in a couple of chairs with the tray between us on a chair, and we began picking things off the tray and eating this huge lunch. and I wanted to say to him, "Do you know what you mean to me? Do you know that when I saw Streetcar, my mind exploded?" Which I didn't, because all he wanted to do was talk about kidney transplants. It turned out he was a friend of the patient who was getting a new kidney, and he wanted to know about rejection and about white blood cells and antibodies and a lot of things that I didn't know anything about, or not very much. So I just told him answers that I had read about in medical school, and then he would think about what I said, and then he would reach across and finger my white coat so he could read my name tag again, and kind of caress it with his fingers, and he would say, "Now, Dr. Liebman, can you tell me this? Can you tell me that?" And he was giving me this degree of respect that you reserve for an expert, which I completely didn't deserve, but it didn't seem to matter because I was his expert, even though to my mind I was only offering him crumbs. And so we went on this way, back and forth for maybe 20 minutes until I had pretty much told him everything I knew that had anything to do with kidney transplants. And it was so strange. I wanted to tell him about my life and how much I wanted to act and that I didn't want to be a doctor. And that would have been so wrong. And so I just kept on being the doctor I didn't want to be. And he kept on being this sort of shy, seductive kid asking questions that he really wanted to figure out, until there was just kind of a natural end to it. And I got up to go and said that it had been nice chatting. And at that point, he reached into his pocket and he got out his wallet and he said, "How much do I owe you?" And the answer to that was nothing, because I had used the meal card. So I said, "I can't take your money," because I really couldn't, not because of who he was, but because it was wrong. But it came out wrong. I didn't know how to say it. And I began to explain about the meal card again and how it was all free anyway. But the spell was broken. And I will never forget the instant where I saw in his eye, "Oh, you know who I am." You know, how could anybody not know? And I wanted to defend myself and say, "No, it's not because of who you are. I'm not going to let you pay me. It's because of who I am, and I'm not going to take money that doesn't belong to me." But I realized it was useless. It was like the moment in the cartoon where the character's running and he runs off a cliff, but he doesn't know it, and he's still running on air, and everything's fine until he looks down, and then he just falls. And I got really embarrassed. I felt kind of ashamed, and so I excused myself, and I kind of mumbled, "I gotta go," and I very awkwardly just got out of there. A couple of years later, I told the story to Peggy Fury, who was my then acting teacher, and I mentioned I had felt bad at the way the encounter had ended, that maybe Brando thought ill of me or something, or felt I had been manipulative. And Peggy said, "No, don't feel bad. How it ended wasn't the point. Do you realize what a gift you gave him?" And I guess I didn't until many years later, when it occurred to me she was right. When Brando got that look in his eye, it meant for him that he now had to go back to being Marlon Brando again, which he didn't want. He would have preferred the scene we were playing, where I was the doctor and he was the friend of the patient, to keep going. But now it was as if someone had said cut, and it wouldn't work anymore. Recently, I was doing a reading of a play I had written, and Dustin Hoffman was in the cast. And during rehearsal, we took a break for lunch, and we were all sitting around telling stories, and somebody said, "Hey, Wayne, tell that one about the time you met Brando." And Dustin said, "You met Brando? Brando is God." So I told the story, and Dustin, who had never met Brando, said, "That's right. That rings true. That's how he was. He never appreciated his own talent." So I guess for two guys who really didn't want to be what they were, it was a fair exchange. And that was my lunch with Marlon.
That story from Wayne Peter Liebman, from the files of Yarn Audio Works, online at www.yarnaudioworks.com. That story was produced by Eric Winnick. You've got attuned to Sidetrack. Some look at a mustard or ketchup bottle and see, well, a bottle. Others see it as a chance to make condiments entertaining. Case in point, a new condiment bottle attachment called spreadheads. They're plastic heads you attach to the bottle, and when you squeeze the bottle, it looks like ketchup is coming out of the head's nose or mustard is coming out of its mouth. Instant entertainment for the kids. Holland Henton is the creator of Spreadheads. I talked with him recently and asked him to tell me more.
Spreadheads is a simple idea that are actual heads with expressions on their face that replace the existing ketchup and mustard bottle caps. And what they do is they turn those ketchup and mustard bottles into an instant toy. So, for instance, on the ketchup head, blood comes out of the nose, or it appears to be blood since it's ketchup. And then on the mustard one, that one actually throws up mustard. So it's a quick way to get kids just involved with their food, and it makes food fun, and it's just an entertaining way for kids to interact with the an actual old bottle.
Yeah, these are cartoon looking plastic faces. One's called Ketchup Charlie and Mustard Marvin. So how did you come up with this idea?
Well, I have four kids, two boys and two girls, and in my effort to feed them and to have fun with them when they eat, I would take bottles, whatever they were, and they would become people. And if you look at a top when you open it up, it's almost got an expression sitting there. So, I'd take the bottles and, play with them and make them throw up and make throw-up sounds and things like that. So I just took that idea and embraced it and actually brought that to life.
Does the world really need something that puts more ketchup and mustard on food? I mean, can we have something maybe that dispenses something healthier to vegetables or something like that, yogurt?
Well, I think, this idea you could actually apply to almost any product. I think the bigger idea is that you can take an ordinary container or condiment bottle or even a hygienic kind of product and turn it into something that will entertain kids, therefore they might use it more.
So I don't know the condiment dispensing industry at all. Are there other products out there like this, and how cutthroat is the market?
Well, that will soon be tell us. I mean, I think that will kind of present itself how cutthroat it is. I think that if you have a big idea, that there certainly will possibly be some copycats out there. But the only thing that I've seen that is kind of similar, I think, has been in the shampoo category. And I think that there are some shampoos targeted towards kids have characters on them, but I don't think any of the characters have actually had a kind of a gross-out factor like these do.
Okay, big question. When it comes to hot dogs, what goes on a hot dog? What's your rule of thumb?
What goes on a hot dog? Well, for me, it's ketchup and relish and a little mustard.
I'm mustard all the way.
So, I definitely want to do a relish head eventually.
A relish head?
Yeah.
What design would be the relish head?
Well, it would definitely come out of the mouth, but as far as the actual character, maybe it could be, maybe instead of a person, it could be an animal this time.
Good. I'm glad you said it would come out of mouth, because I was kind of afraid that you might be working on, say, a butt or something like that.
Well, I do have a mayonnaise head in mind that could possibly be a person popping a pimple.
Well, if people want to find more about Spreadheads and get their own, where should they go?
They should go to thespreadheads.com.
That was Holland Henton, creator of Spreadheads. Still to come, we hear about why the music magazine Innocent Words has become a web-only publication. And we take a tour of the Glore Psychiatric Museum. Stay tuned. This is Sidetrack. Since 2001, Innocent Words has covered independent music, both locally and nationally. But this magazine, like many other publications, has seen the landscape, both in the newspaper and magazine business, and in the music business, change dramatically. At the end of last year, Innocent Words changed from a print magazine to a web-only publication. The man behind Innocent Words is publisher Troy Michael. I talked with him recently and asked him the reason behind his move to an internet-only magazine.
I think it's timing for us. I'm more of an old-school type person. I love actual print magazines myself. But I think it's the digital age, as much as some of us hate to say that, it's just going to give us so much more options than just a print magazine. We did really, really well with the print magazine, but we feel we can do even better with more options with online only.
Now, you guys have been around since 2001. That's when you started the magazine. You also have a record label as well.
Yes.
Does economics play a part in this? I mean, because industry-wide, a lot of magazines and newspapers are either downsizing or declaring bankruptcy or just folding altogether. I mean, does that play a part in your transition to from print to the web?
Yes, it does. And it's not the major reason and the only reason, but it does play a part. We were a free magazine to begin with, but to stay a free magazine, we had to sell advertising. And when we first started out, advertising was great. And I noticed the last couple years of the print magazine that ads were getting more and more scarce because people didn't know where the music industry was going and their ad budgets were cut and all their money was spent on the major ads for major magazines. So being a DIY type person, a do-it-yourself, you know, we were kind of on the bottom rung when it comes to money. And so I don't like to say money was a huge issue, but it did play its part in going to internet only.
Well, you guys were distributed in, according to your website, 17 states and 46 cities.
Yeah.
And that wasn't enough to sustain a print magazine.
It was. We could have stayed a print magazine, but I think the options were getting down to the bottom, you know, of what could we do. I think we took the print magazine itself as far as it could go, and I've always thought we would expand to the internet only because that's where everybody was going, but I also believe that We did as much as we could with the print magazine over the 7 years. And when I first got into this and started Innocent Words, I sought out a lot of help as far as advice from other record labels and print magazines. And the common denominator was, if you can last 3 years as a print magazine, you better consider that a success. And we lasted seven, so I think we did more than our share of spreading the word as far as, you know, a physical copy of a magazine. And now I think we are able to amplify that with the online version of Innocent Words. Like I said, options is the main reason we switched over.
Well, in 7 years, I'm sure you've seen a huge transformation in the music industry itself.
Oh, yeah.
So how does that affect what you've published, and what does that landscape look like for bands, say, you know, from 2001 to a band coming up in 2009?
I think as far as bands go, I think the internet is a blessing to music, and it's a curse at the same time. As far as what I mean by that, with MySpace, Facebook, just about anybody with a guitar and the knowledge of a computer can consider themselves a musician and make a demo CD or, you know, put four songs online and say, hey, I'm a musician, without having to pass it over to anybody like a magazine, like a record label, or like a PR company, and get their input. Back even in 2001 when we started, and even before, I mean, years before that, people would make music, and they would have to say, or have to give it to a label or a PR company and so forth, or even a promoter to say, hey, can we play your club? And a lot of people would get turned down, and those people aren't getting turned down anymore. So the curse is there's a ton of music out there that, for lack of a better word, is crap. But at the same time, if a kid can pick up a guitar and try to make music, God bless him for it. I mean, we need people like that. And you just hope you find that one special artist that you want to write about that, like, blows you back and say, hey, this is why I started Innocent Words. And that happens to me several times a year, and I'm lucky for it. And then we want to write about those people.
Well, it seems like a lot of music publications up until now had that push of corporate record labels to move that music into the direction of magazines, and then hopefully, you know, people would buy it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that has changed as well, too.
Yeah, it's kind of well known that the major record labels, you know, push an artist that they think can succeed financially more than they can succeed, you know, in their personal music goals. And I've heard, you know, several people say that record labels, major-wise, are able to drop down money for giant ads. Like, if they could buy a full-page advertisement, they seem to get the better reviews than, say, an independent label. And it's not fair, but it works a lot that way sometimes, unfortunately. And with the economy the way it is and the music industry changing, the people that were on the lower rung as far as, like, independents go, it's tough to compete with that. And, I mean, everybody's scared about their money right now with the change in office and, you know, the way things were going with the Bush administration, but that's a whole different story.
So is print dead? Is the era of the DIY music magazine and zine and publication, is that over with?
I sure hope not. It scares me to even think about that. Like I said, I've been in the music industry for practically my whole life. I worked at Record Service for 4 or 5 years as a manager at the CD store, and when I worked there, CD stores were dropping a dime a dozen, and independent CD stores and mainstream CD stores are few and far between now, and print magazines are getting to be the same way, and unfortunately, I don't want to say they're dead, but they're certainly on life support.
So if people want to check out your online version of Innocent Words, where can they go to, and what sorts of things are you featuring right now?
Anybody that wants to find us, we can go to innocentwords.com. We also have a MySpace page. Just go to myspace.com/innocentwords, and they can find pretty much everything that we had in the magazine, plus more. now that we're going to internet, we're going to slowly progress to be a monthly magazine, if not a weekly, with weekly interviews. But right now, we're feeling out the waters, and we're keeping it going every other month right now until we get everything squared away. I had a little setback due to some health issues myself, so we're a little bit behind on where I want to be, but we're progressing, and I like that. We're still doing our, you know, 5 to 10 interviews with bands every issue. We're still putting out 30 CD reviews every issue, book reviews. We're getting quite a bit of those now, and DVD reviews. And where we go from that, this year we're going to, you know, fine-tune the website and bring more options in. For example, we're thinking about creating an internet radio online stream where people can come in and they can read a review about a certain band and then go to our streaming radio station and pick up a song from that band to see if they like them. And we'll co-work with record labels on that, about having them give us more tracks as each issue goes along. We're also bringing in all our writers are going to have the option of having a blog section for the magazine, and we're going to bring in some, what I feel is pretty big name independent artists to be our guest bloggers. We're going to have somebody new with each issue that, you know, pretty well known as far as I'm concerned, to, you know, write about whatever they want. Could be music, could be politics, could be life. It's kind of a free-for-all, you know. If I don't like to censor people, and we like to get as many opinions as we can out there, and that goes for the reviews and interviews too, because everybody, maybe I don't like a certain band, but if one of our writers loves the band, you know, I'm all for it. I'll help. I started the magazine to help independent artists get more coverage, and I think as Innocent Words progressed, we've done that with especially local. And even though the local scene is a little bit down right now, but I think we've helped the independent artists maybe get some more press, if not in central Illinois, nationwide, that they might have not gotten before. So that's I kind of like to help the struggling artists, because I see myself as one myself.
Well, best of luck to you and your new online version of Innocent Words.
Thank you very much.
That was Troy Michael, publisher of Innocent Words magazine, which recently went from a print publication to internet only. You're listening to Sidetrack. The Glor Psychiatric Museum in St. Joseph, Missouri, has been called one of the 50 most unusual museums in the country. But the word unusual doesn't do it justice. The Glor Museum is a testament to man's failed attempts to understand mental illness. Independent producer Michael Paul Mason takes us on a tour.
I stumbled on it by accident. I happened to be driving through northern Missouri on my way to Iowa when I decided to pull into St. Joseph, Missouri for a meal. On the way into town, I caught sight of a sign that read Glor Psychiatric Museum. Although I currently work at a mental health hospital in Oklahoma, my background didn't prepare me for what I would see inside the Glor.
I'm Kathy Reno. I do marketing and public relations for the Glor Psychiatric Museum. We're a museum to the history of what was once known as State Lunatic Asylum No. 2, believe it or not. That was its name when it opened in 1874. We also chronicle the history of the treatment of mental illness in general.
The Glor Psychiatric Museum houses several floors of exhibits that display mankind's attempts to treat mental disorders. It's a museum to failure, if you will. Some of the displays expose a side of humanity that we'd prefer not to look at. In fact, they make you feel sort of uncomfortable.
You see the actual hydrotherapy tub and how that worked with the actual equipment and the canvas that would have covered the tub. And, of course, you'd have towels around the patient. So, obviously, we've used mannequins to depict that. Then you see the actual hospital bed where they would use wet sheet packs. They would be frozen. You'd wrap them around the patient. Their body heat would cause the ice to melt. It would flow over their body, and they could relax and sleep.
So maybe you didn't catch that. They used to wrap mentally ill people in frozen blankets to calm them down. Right next to that is what you might call another relaxation technique.
That is a marble table that was used in clonic irrigation. It's basically an enema table.
So it's a marble slab.
It's a marble slab. There was...
With a large hole in it.
Right, right. And there was a flushing toilet. Obviously, that's a medical...
So what are these two devices right here? Did you notice me switching the topic right away there? That's sort of... discomfort mixed with embarrassment, it never really lets up while you're at the Glor. That's part of the point of the museum. I'll give you an example. Like, right across the exhibit that we were looking at, there's a case filled with a box full of what looks like rubber drapery finials, right? In large antique letters, the box says, rectal dilators. And I pretend not to see it, and I can see the relief in Kathy's eyes. She directs me to the shock therapy display instead.
Well, this is electroconvulsive therapy, and this is the equipment that our hospital had used when they did those particular types of treatments. That's actually, I noticed that they showed this particular procedure in a new movie. The Changeling shows you exactly how that works. This is something that was an early treatment, as most of our exhibits are, and this is one that they decided was not productive for a long, long time. Now it's come back into use, but the procedure's changed entirely so that they've eliminated the side effects. In this case, we show the doctor and the patient and what the equipment looks like. The equipment was actually used here in the mid-1940s. It just basically involves sending electric shock,
through the brain. Down at the end of the hall is a small collection of various mannequins wearing highly restrictive garments.
Well, early restraints sometimes were, people think of the classic straitjacket, but in the early years that was not used. They might have been a simple cloth camisole, as you see on the right, just a simple cloth strapped camisole, or something that resembles an apron. Or you might put gloves on a patient if they were someone that was dangerous to themselves. Or obviously you see that some of the restraints are leather. Not the typical straitjackets that we think of.
The way Kathy explains it, she sounds almost like a nurse trying to sell a patient on the idea of putting on the straitjacket. It's just a camisole, really. Go ahead, try it on. Right next to those mannequins, there's this glass case that says early tranquilizers. They look like primitive nightsticks with the handles wrapped in tape.
These are obviously just leather straps that they would use to control a patient. Because as I mentioned, Thorazine did not come out until 1959, began to be used widely around that period. So before that, you have to deal with uncontrollable patients in other ways. Fortunately, I mean, that's way, way, way in the past.
But But to be clear about what's in the case, these look like
leather clubs.
Leather.
They resemble leather clubs to a degree, exactly.
At the far end of the hall is a large room filled with replicas of mental health techniques used long before the opening of State Lunatic Asylum. The first thing Kathy points me to is a small, black wooden chair. It sort of looks like an electric chair without the cables.
The tranquilizer chair was actually the invention of the father of American psychiatry, Dr. Benjamin Rush. His theory was, as you can tell from looking at the chair, it's a chair where the patient is strapped in. There's a hood over their head, part of a box. He thought the patient's strapped in, their muscles will relax, they'll be calm. Deprived of that type of senses, they'll relax, they'll quiet. There's actually a bucket in the bottom because if they're strapped into the chair, obviously you still need to use the bathroom, so I think that's pretty clear. From the chair they could be bled, because that was another theory, that disease was carried in the blood. They thought bodily fluids were part of the problem. So that is the reason for the chair. Of course, this chair to us seems very strange, but he was experimenting with how you could help people come back to reality. Well, this is a Utica crib. That's what it was called in Europe. We called them restraint cages. This is from the middle of the 19th century. It looks almost like a wooden coffin, except there are wooden slats, like dowel rods. So obviously, the patient is not stuck in a box, per se. And once again, the purpose of this was for bleeding. Also, this might be a way to get a patient to calm, and then they would be released.
The mannequin in the Utica crib looks completely at ease, like she's waiting for a routine teeth cleaning or something. Next to her is a huge wooden model that reaches clear up to the ceiling. And Kathy's eyes light up.
This is my personal favorite. This is late 18th century. It's a hollow wheel. I always think of it as a gerbil wheel. Anybody that had gerbils as a child, this is easy to visualize. It, instead of being something that's constructed for a gerbil, it's constructed for obviously a tall human being. It's made completely out of wood, and it operates on the same principle. Before the days of modern medications, if you have an agitated patient, and of course they'd never heard of attention deficit disorder, would not have known what that meant, they can run off their extra energy inside this wheel where they're not a danger to themselves or anyone else. And of course the patient will wear themselves out and then they'll be calmer. Also, they discover that once you calm down and you stop moving, the wheel stops moving too. If you want the wheel to stop moving, you have to stop moving. And they really thought this might help them.
How long would they be on the wheel?
I'm sure that depended on the patient.
The display next to the hollow wheel states that patients were generally kept inside 36 to 48 hours. Kathy points out a number of other displays around the room.
Now we're going to the bath of surprise with 17th century.
This
is stomping or stepping on a patient because they believed in demonology.
That's
or
actually
of blistering.
It spins the body at up to 100 RPMs. Obviously, that's going to make you dizzy. You might purge.
While Kathy tells me about the displays, I notice that there are a few times where she almost tries to downplay their inhumanity.
I know another device sounds terribly barbaric to us. Once again, you have to remember, I know once again, this is just another attempt to shock your back into being
trying to get you to come get back. Your behavior.
It's kind of like she's trying to say, see, humanity really isn't a bad race. We mean well, really. The Glore Museum got me thinking. Some of those exhibits were, you know, just around 50 years old. Not old at all, really. When it comes to treating the mentally ill, how can we be sure that we aren't making the same mistakes today that we've made very recently?
Well, in life, we tend not to know what we don't know, Mike. Now, that's one of the problems we have. We think that what we do is correct and just, We think back about psychosurgery, and we've talked about that and how nobody would do a lobotomy anymore because it's a horrible procedure and look at the after effects. But in reality, at the time, people thought they were doing the right thing. They were changing the nature of mental illness for people by doing surgery. I'm Rolf Gaynor. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Brookhaven Hospital and founder of the Neurologic Rehabilitation Institute of Ontario. Well, if we look back at the last 50 years and the changes that have occurred in medications that were used in the 1950s that were revolutionary and changed psychiatry and enabled deinstitutionalization to occur, if we were to fast forward to 100 years from now, I would think that those medications are going to be much different, much better able to target symptoms, produce less side effects than today's medications.
From listening to Dr. Gaynor, you can get the implication. Today's medications aren't that precise, not compared to what they will be. Are antidepressants just a modern-day version of bloodletting? Can we really say that mental health treatment has progressed all that much?
Well, I think there's been some tremendous advancement in work in areas like transcranial stimulation, which has been very effective so far. I think we'll see science move in that direction. I also think we'll see advances in designing new medications that are more effective at targeting symptoms, producing less side effects. I think we'll see a great deal of change in how psychiatry is practiced and how psychology is practiced. But some things won't change. People do better with counseling. People do better in relationships that are helpful and therapeutic. I don't know that we're ever going to replace those. So who knows? You know, we just don't have that capacity as people to exert judgment necessarily on all the things that we do and determine what's going to be right and what's going to be wrong.
In other words, Kathy was kind of right. As humans, we're terribly flawed when it comes to assessing our ability to take care of each other. And the sad thing is that most of the time, it's the object of our compassion that ends up suffering as a result of our intervention. But we do mean well. We do. Really.
That story from independent producer Michael Paul Mason. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. All the past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580 WILL Urbana.